Following programming is sponsored by Clean and Sober Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
If you need immediate help, please call the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. Welcome to Clean and Sober Radio, brought to you in part by Recovery Centers of America, the nationally recognized leader in drug and alcohol treatment, using proven evidence-based treatment, including 24/7 medically supervised detox, inpatient and outpatient options. You'll receive exceptional care from an expert team of master-level clinicians, physicians, nurses, and staff using 12-step methodology and medications. Jefferson University Hospitals and Thomas Jefferson University, providing excellent clinical and compassionate care in the Philadelphia region, a proven leader in healthcare and education since 1825, and Acadia Healthcare, with locations on the East Coast. Acadia maintains a standard for excellence in the treatment of behavioral health and addiction concerns. And now, here are your hosts, Gary Hendler and Mark Sigmund.
Hey, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show. Clean and Sober Radio features real people with real stories about addiction to drugs and alcohol. We first like to thank some of the great stations across America that carry Clean and Sober Radio. They are WWDB out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, WWNN out of Boca Raton, Florida, WHFS out of Tampa, Florida, KDWN out of Las Vegas, Nevada, and very soon we're going to be on the radio station in Augusta, Georgia, WGAC-AM.
Exciting stuff, Gary. We're getting the message out even more, which is great to see.
Absolutely. On today's show, we're going to be talking with two gentlemen who have been giving back in their recovery to an extent that is almost unheard of. So we're going to be really excited about our guests when we start the show. But let's find out, Mark, right now what's new this week in recovery news.
Interesting stuff. So a study just came out that people who have had COVID-19 face a greater risk of developing an opioid use disorder. According to the BMJ Medical Journal, the study looked at records of 154,000 COVID patients in Veterans Health and Administration System. They were 34% more likely to develop opioid use disorder during the year after having COVID-19. Some prescriptions for pain meds were given. Sometimes people following COVID had more pain issues. But a 34% increase is pretty high.
That is very high. But you know what makes a lot of sense? You said, people were in a state of mind or in a situation where they took more meds, either out of boredom, out of, you know, falling, who knows what, mm-hmm. what went on. But there was a lot of people that were compromised during the epidemic, and that makes a lot of sense, although that number seems really high.
It really does, and it's traumatic too, right? So you have the trauma of getting COVID-19 and worrying about what's going to happen, and then next thing you know, prescribed meds and abusing them.
Right. What else you got, Mark?
So something just came out about Purdue Pharmaceuticals. A mediator on Thursday came out and said that they will soon outline recommendations for ending the Purdue Pharma's bankruptcy, which is expected to provide billions of dollars to address the opioid crisis that the OxyContin maker has been accused of fueling, a company spokesman said Thursday. So that's actually good news if we're going to see billions of dollars. But I don't know if I'm skeptical.
Well, you know, we're going to be talking during the show partly about the pharmaceutical companies that have tried to destroy our communities. All right. So listen, so when we come back, we're going to be talking with Bill Stolfer and Ryan Hampton. And we're going to find out a lot of interesting stuff that's going on across this country in our world. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
If you're struggling with alcohol or drugs, Recovery Centers of America can help. RCA's local inpatient and outpatient programs are founded on science and delivered with heart from an expert, caring team who will inspire and guide you every step of the way. Call 1-888-RECOVERY now to speak with a treatment advisor. At RCA, you'll be in a community that builds connections and fosters support from peers and RCA's team of medical professionals and recovery support specialists. At RCA's state-of-the-art campus in Devon, PA, and Mays Landing, New Jersey, they tailor your treatment to you and also offer specialized programs for patients with history of trauma, for patients who have achieved recovery but are experiencing a relapse, for young adults, adults 50 years and older, a confidential program for first responders and military, and a faith-based program. RCA answers the phone and accepts patients 24/7. And because it's local and in-network with insurance providers, treatment is affordable and accessible. Don't wait. Call 1-888-RECOVERY today.
Hi, this is Bobby Rydell, and you're listening to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Mark, so, you know, I believe there's different stages of getting into recovery. The first is getting clean. That means abstinence. Mm-hmm. The second is getting sober, which you change your lifestyle as you start to get involved with the world, educate yourself. And the third step is giving back. And, you know, there are people that give back. There are not a lot of people that give back. Our guests today do just that. Bill Stouffer is executive director of the Pennsylvania Recovery Organization Alliance. He is an advocate for those in active addiction and recovery to secure the rights of individuals in recovery and those trying to get in recovery. And Ryan Hampton, who is our other guest, is a nationally recognized speaker, author, media commentator, and has rocketed to the center of America's rising addiction recovery advocacy movement. A former White House staffer, Ryan most recently was appointed as a board member by the United States Department of Justice, overseeing the Purdue Pharma bankruptcy by representing victims impacted by the opioid crisis. Ryan, are you on the line?
I am. It's good to be here.
Hey, it's great to be here. You're on the line. You're in Vegas right now, and Bill Stouffer is in the studio with us, and we're just happy to have both you guys with us today. So welcome to Clean and Sober Radio. So let's start off with Ryan. What's your story?
Well, I'm first and foremost, a person in recovery. I just celebrated 7 years on February 2nd.
Congratulations.
Congrats.
Yep. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, prior to that, spent the better part of a decade on the streets, homeless, addicted to opioids, other drugs. And, you know, by the grace of something way bigger than me, and also, I like to say, Medicaid, I was able to find treatment and get help and enter recovery February 2nd, 2015. You know, prior to my journey with addiction, you mentioned in my bio, I did have kind of this up-and-coming career in politics. I had worked in the White House. I had worked for labor campaigns. I had worked for governors and senators and on Capitol Hill. And that all changed for me during a hiking trip in 2003, where I was prescribed opioids for the first time. And my journey into addiction was not protracted whatsoever. It was very quick and very steep. But the reason that I do what I do today, just mentioned some of my bio, you know, the advocacy, the work that I was doing on the Purdue Pharma bankruptcy, the founding of the Voices Project and Recovery Advocacy Project, and working on issues for to ensure, you know, equitable access to care for people who are struggling with addiction or those in recovery, right? And to really break those biases and systemic discrimination that exists against folks like us in our communities wasn't necessarily because of my own story. It was after I got, you know, sober, after I got into recovery, I really started experiencing a lot of friends of mine dying. You know, people who were trying to get help, people who were being denied housing or being denied employment, and basically being told that this is kind of how the world turns, right? That this is what we have to deal with. And I just didn't think that that was a reasonable answer. And so, you know, literally, as the story goes, I mean, with $20 and a laptop that was, you know, that we got at a pawn shop, and hijacking our neighbor's internet from next door at the sober house I was living at in 2015 and 2016, we started the Voices Project, which at its core is about lifting up the voices of people in recovery and people who are impacted by addiction, to make sure their voices are front and center when it comes to policy decisions, and really holding, you know, power brokers accountable. Because a lot of the rhetoric that we hear from folks about addressing the overdose crisis, the addiction crisis in this country, sounds great as news bites and talking points. But when it really comes to the rubber hitting the road, we just don't see the action matching the type of rhetoric that we're hearing.
And that's so very true. You know, without government supporting us, nothing's going to get done. I want to bring Bill Stoffer into the conversation. And I'm just curious, guys, what you think. You know, a lot of us got clean and sober, but not a lot of us have gotten involved in really making a difference. And I'm just wondering, Bill and Ryan, why do you think you guys decided, you know, that just getting clean wasn't enough? Why did you guys decide to really give back and be grateful and, you know, help others who still needed help? Bill, what's your take on that?
I would just say, you know, I'm in recovery for 35 years. I got in recovery at age 21, got involved in this work of helping people relatively early on. And like Ryan, I've lost more people I know to addiction than every other issue combined. And as Ryan said, that we're not doing a good job at taking care of people. And essentially, we've normalized care that isn't providing what we need. And I would say this. So I've been involved for a long time, so I understand some of the policy. I've always had an interest in those kinds of things. But the reality is that there are many people like us. There's nothing unique about Ryan and I. There's an entire recovery community that is, it's the greatest untapped resource in America to help in this recovery process, which we desperately need. And as Ryan indicated, we have not, the rhetoric has not matched the kinds of things that we need to help people. So, I mean, you know, we're helping get people into the process and make sure that voices are involved in processes and holding people accountable for the fact that almost none of the resources go to where they need to help people in the long term.
You know, I've often said on the show, and I think Mark would agree with me, that the government is not, obviously, on a federal level for sure, is not really doing it. And I believe that it's human nature that people, unless they are directly affected by somebody with an addiction, really don't care that much. You know, it's almost like if you don't know somebody that's blind, I don't know if you – I mean, you can sympathize and empathize. I don't know if you're going to get into start backing programs for the blind. I really believe it's human nature that if you're not affected by it, it's really somebody else's problem. Ryan, what do you think?
Let me jump in on that, and I apologize because I'm getting like some feedback as I'm talking, a little bit of an echo. So I apologize on that if it's coming through on your end. I actually subscribe that everyone is impacted, and I think this is one of the biggest challenges that we have as a recovery community, is convincing and presenting the evidence to the American public that everyone is impacted, right? We know that untreated addiction, the overdose crisis in this country, is costing the United States of America over close to $1 trillion a year, and that is probably a conservative estimate, right?
Yeah.
These are costs that communities are paying in healthcare, they're paying in criminal justice costs, they're paying in social services, they're paying in lost productivity in their workplaces, right? They're paying in higher insurance premiums. And so one of the things when I got involved in advocacy and when I really started grabbing a hold of this recovery movement was, how do we start to talk about the benefits of a vibrant and open and diverse recovery community and productive recovery community, while also talking about the consequences of not putting recovery front and center in our communities. And in other issues, you look at people's pocketbooks, you look at their wallets, and there is a direct economic impact for us ignoring this issue. And I think that once we learn as a community the right ways to communicate these messages to people who may not feel they are impacted, I think we do better. And this has been one of the largest challenges I have had in my time, you know, talking to Congress or state legislators, or even of late, you know, working on the Purdue Pharma bankruptcy. Policymakers and some power brokers in our communities believe this issue only impacts a small amount, right? They only think it impacts that sliver of people in recovery or sliver of people who are impacted by addiction. And they couldn't be that couldn't be anything further from the truth. And we have empirical data to prove it.
Yeah, I agree. Listen, we agree with you 100%. But I believe that if somebody really can't feel it in their pocketbook, they don't care. And it is about – it's all about education. And I think it is going in the right direction, Ryan. I think through the media, through people like you and us, it's starting to make a difference. And people are starting to say, hey, I'm lucky my kids don't have a problem, but Mary Jane down the street has it, and I'd like to learn a little bit more about it, and I'd like to be supportive. But I think it's a hard sell, but it is going in the right direction, you know?
I mean as a follow-up, though, and I'd like to hear Bill's take on this. I mean, part of the largest issue that we have is that we are still, right, and this I think is a qualifier for anybody in recovery, anybody who is struggling with addiction, any family member who has lost someone to an overdose or a family member in recovery, we are still seen as different. We are still seen as separate.
Yeah.
We are not seen as equals amongst, you know, the rest of our populations. There's still a mark on us. And unless and until we're able to combat that systemic discrimination and prejudice, which is just, I mean, some people call it stigma, but that's really what it is, we're going to have a hard time accomplishing other agenda items that may fall under that.
Yeah, if you've just joined us now, we're speaking with Bill Stolfer and Ryan Hampton. These are two guys that across America are trying to educate, and they're trying to be advocates, and they are for people in our community who don't either know what their rights are or know how to go through the process of getting help. So listen, if you want to join this conversation, give us a call at 1-888-329-3306. That's 1-888-329-3306, right, Mark?
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that's very head scratching to me, and maybe you guys can help me out on this, is I keep hearing about all this money that was set aside for the pandemic and stuff, but also to address the opioid epidemic. And I'd like to know, as a taxpayer, where is this money going? You know, I mean, you keep hearing
and
these
who's
numbers.
Distributing it? Who's in charge?
Who's lining their pockets?
Yeah, so I want to get follow up with what Ryan had asked about it, talked about, and I concur with him. Like, if this was heart disease, and we went out and said, listen, people need more than heart surgery, they're going to need aftercare and follow up, and we're going to make sure that these needs get met. Or if somebody gets cancer, you don't give them three chemotherapies and send them out the door. We need to follow people for 5 years. It's a serious thing, and we need to help them get better, or else we all pay a consequence. That's the truth. You know, the reality is that we have this parity law in America, and Secretary Walsh, person in recovery, highest member of an administration ever in open recovery in the United States, put together a report to Congress. None of the insurance companies that they audited were in initial compliance when they took a look to see if those if they were following the law. Zero were in compliance, and people aren't getting what they need. So, I mean, that's the first factor. So before you even get the public dollars, think about this. We want to have insurance pay for things before they end up on the responsibility of the taxpayers. And so in 14 years, this is the most serious effort to see if that law was being followed. So, that, you know, that's number one. But where is the money going is a really good question. And what we hope to see is people in recovery more involved with where the money goes. I recently testified in a Pennsylvania Senate hearing, and I heard that $32 million was going to recovery in Pennsylvania. None of us can find it. Our organization gets zero. There, I can think of two recovery organizations that are getting money. $30 million, we can't figure out where it's going. It's not going to our communities. And here's the most important thing. People heal together. This is what we know in the recovery community. You know this. We all know this. The money doesn't go to the community healing. It seems to go. I don't want to ruin Ryan's book and what happens with Unsettled, and we talks about the Purdue Pharma bankruptcy process. But essentially, the people get left out, and there's a parallel between what happened there and what's happening with these resources.
Bill, you have a lot of connections in Pennsylvania, in the House and stuff. Is there anybody there who really cares?
I think there are a lot of people who care, but we need to focus that caring. I know Ryan had wanted to say something.
I just, you brought up a very interesting comparison, and it really lights my fire. You talk about COVID and COVID dollars. And what I am about to say is not to take away from COVID one bit, because it is a real crisis. It is the other declared public health crisis in this country. There are two federally declared public health crises in this country. One is COVID. The other one is overdose. The difference, though, is that seemingly overnight with COVID, $2 trillion was deployed. We had testing in literally every single corner in this country. It felt like overnight. We had dollars going to states, to counties. We had grants going out to businesses and individuals to provide COVID mitigation measures for them. We had business loans that were handed out left and right. We had daily White House briefings once the death toll hit 100,000 people who had died of COVID. Congress has appropriated 800 times the amount of money that they have than they have for overdose on COVID. Yet we have surpassed, for the first time in American history, 100,000 overdose deaths. Deaths due to drugs, and if you include alcohol, that number is probably closer to 400,000 deaths, right? For every 9 COVID deaths in this country, you have 1 drug overdose death. If you include alcohol, it's more like 9 to 4, yet it's crickets when it comes to overdose. So the disparity in how we treat public health crises in this country is absolutely clear. And we should be asking our question, the question why, and we should be mad as hell at Congress and our state legislators for pushing us aside.
Well, you got the numbers right, and it's, as Mark said or Bill said, if this was any chronic disease, diabetes, cancer, multiple sclerosis, anything, these folks would not be, they'd be treated differently than the people in our community. All right, let's do this real quick. I just want to give Kathy Wolf Collins is celebrating 24 years today.
Fantastic.
Andrea Duffy. Hey, Judge, what's up? Michael Shoemaker is watching from Tennessee. Laura Story is watching. Debbie Reynolds is watching. Dan Shamalin, happy Clean and Sober Radio Day. Thanks, Gary and Mark, and welcome, Bill. So, listen, when we come back, we're going to be talking again with Bill Stauffer and Ryan Hampton. And I want to get into – I'd like to know what happened, how it happened with Purdue Pharmaceutical. So we'll be right back.
This is Clean Sober Radio.
Huntington Creek Recovery Center is Eastern Pennsylvania's premier provider of transformative care for individuals whose lives have been impacted by addiction. Our 40-acre campus offers a tranquil, recovery-focused environment. We specialize in evidence-based care that addresses the effects of trauma and offer a unique program specifically for adolescent males. Huntington Creek Recovery Center can help you achieve lasting sobriety. Call us today at 844-948-2320.
Hey, man, this is Ricky Bird, former member of Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, an inductee to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as of 2015. And I listen to Clean and Sober Radio, and so do my friends here, right?
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Hey, we want everybody to know, if you need help, there is a national number right now to call, 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-4357. These phones are manned by professional people, and they will do their best to get you help. And listen, guys, listening and watching, there is help out there. You know, we say there's no delivery service and there's no drive-through, but there are plenty of places to get help, and there are plenty of places to get help for free, including meetings.
Yeah, and get it early. Get it early. Don't wait till the lowest of low bottoms. You know, reach out for help very early.
Absolutely. I want to talk a little bit right now about Purdue Pharma. And, Ryan, I know you're the expert on that. I'd like to know how you came to being involved in that process, where the process is, what is the outcome if there is one, and has any money been distributed?
Oh, goodness. Well, how much time do you have?
Well, we have about 25 minutes.
All right. So I'll try and give you the quick notes version.
Okay.
I mean, I, you know, when I got sober, when I was using, I didn't know who the Sackler family was. I knew about Purdue because it was a name on the side of the bottle for medications that I was at that point misusing. And when I got sober, and friends of mine started dying, some from prescription drug overdoses, some from heroin overdoses, I really started to nail in some research on why is this happening. And I came across Purdue, came across the Sackler family name, really got involved in disruptive activism to hold them accountable in 2018. I co-hosted the largest action in front of the Purdue headquarters in Stamford, Connecticut ever, where we brought 500 people together and were really loud. It was a very loud protest to demand that the Sacklers, who were the family that owned Purdue at the time, they had not stepped off the board yet, that they divest their profits into community-based resources, into recovery and treatment and harm reduction and family support services. And I, around that time, had published my first book, American Fix, where I talked about Purdue and the Sacklers extensively. So this advocacy against kind of this corporate greed that was just a breeding ground for it at Purdue were some of my first actions. And when Purdue pulled the ripcord from what is known as the multi-district litigation, which is where Johnson & Johnson and Teva and AmerisourceBergen and other CVS, Caremark are bundled into lawsuits in Ohio, Purdue saw that their liability was too high, and they decided to pull the ripcord and file for bankruptcy, which took them out of Judge Polster's courtroom in Ohio and essentially put them into Judge Drain's courtroom in White Plains, New York, in a bankruptcy venue. It changed the entire ballgame. It meant that, you know, the case would not be tried the same way as the other distributors and manufacturers. It would be tried as according to bankruptcy law, which favors the corporation, right? And it's about restructuring the corporation so it could pay its debts. As a part of the bankruptcy process, and this was all a very quick education for me, the United States Department of Justice had to appoint a committee that would essentially serve as the mega plaintiff, right? So if you thought of Purdue as the defendant in the bankruptcy case and there would be a plaintiff, that would have been this committee that the DOJ had to appoint. And I applied for the committee, met with the DOJ, United States trustee, in September of 2019, and they appointed me as a member of this nine-member committee. What I can tell you, though, is I entered the process feeling that there might be a sliver of justice for our communities. I thought that, as you said at the beginning of your broadcast, how there are all these billions of dollars coming down and we can't do this without government. Well, I actually, hell, I was quite innocent, I think, in my thinking to think that, yes, we all were on the same side, state attorneys general, counties, governments, even the other corporations that were creditors, and that you had Purdue and the Sacklers on the other side of the table. They were bad. Everybody else was good. But what I learned when I got into that process over 2 years in confidential negotiations, depositions, millions of pages of discovery, was that it was the government's intent to keep those dollars as far away from the individuals who were actually harmed as they could. It was maddening. I wrote about it in Unsettled. I've been very vocal about it. The status of the case right now, I'm actually hitting refresh on my computer as we speak because the mediator is going to be delivering their final report. We're supposed to be delivering their final report to see if there is a settlement. But the settlement structure is 92.5% of those dollars will go to government and corporations. No. Only 7.5% will go to the individuals who were actually harmed, the people who had claims against this company. Yeah. And we actually had an opportunity on that 92.5% going to government and corporations to have an allocation that would go to recovery community organizations, that would go to the community supports that Bill had mentioned, non-clinical supports with peers. And we were told to essentially take a hike, that if the government didn't control how these dollars were being spent, there would be no dollars at all. So when the history of the Purdue Pharma story and Purdue Pharma bankruptcy, and I believe opioid litigation is written, I believe it's going to be one of the most catastrophic public health failures this country has ever seen, even worse than tobacco.
Unbelievably depressing and it's really horrible. We have John Hollis on the line. John, what's up, buddy?
Hey, John.
Hey, man. Hey, you know, great show. And, you know, we've been talking about this since 2008, 2009, when, you know, they were, you know, told that they were predators back then and fined for it. When you look at this overall process of what's happened with SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration of Washington, D.C., and everybody else that is in the fold with the opioid epidemic, I tend to believe that when you start to look at their back ends, when you're spending $2 or $3 million on events for education, how many beds could have been given for that same $2 or $3 million?
Well, that's, you know, that's true, but that's, you know, and that's, let me just say, that's totally true. But we can, you know, correlate that to so many other things that happen with the irresponsible spending of monies, that the monies could have gone to good causes to help people. But they just don't seem to trickle down that way, do they, John?
No, they don't. And I think that the other process that he was saying, I was going to ask and he brought it up and it was great, is the Sackler family. I mean, where is the justice in the fact that they killed, you know, 500,000 people?
Yeah.
Well, if I could just answer that briefly. So that's a very good question. The Sackler family has been able to negotiate, or so far, I mean, they negotiate a release. That's what we're waiting for the mediator's report today. But there are reports that say that their contribution into the settlement can be upwards of $5 billion, right? The problem with all this is that, yes, the Sacklers should be putting a tremendous amount of money into this settlement, but the scope of what the bankruptcy court can do, and even certain attorneys general, is limited. there is no criminal release. And I think people get this confused. In this settlement, there is no criminal release. There may be a civil release. And what most advocates and family members who have been impacted want is for the Sackler family to face the same type of justice that you and I would if we were caught with a crime that's 0.0001% of what they did. That jurisdiction falls under the United States Department of Justice, who as of today, under Attorney General Garland, have not even, or any United States attorney in this country, have had the Sackler family sit for a grand jury. They haven't been indicted. They haven't been charged. So, I mean, this is a gripe that we have been taking up with the DOJ for some time now, and it is mind-boggling that there hasn't been a criminal charge against the Sacklers. And I equate it to what we call in the U.S. as billionaire justice. I mean, that's really what we're talking about here.
Or the injustice. And that, you know, that's a familiar theme in all levels of socioeconomic people. You know, the very poor get hammered. Look, if Sacklers don't go to the penitentiary, you know, there are people sitting in prison right now for decades because they sold some methamphetamine or some pot. But the people who really have killed people and harmed people, they get away with it. That's how this country operates, unfortunately, guys.
Well, and I'm just curious about this. So let me get this straight. So that's going to be billions of dollars, this settlement. And 7% is going to go to the community and the rest is going to corporations. Like what kind of corporations?
So it's 7.5% that will go to the individuals who are harmed, right? So a mother who lost her child or a father who lost their child to an overdose, they will get very little. In any corporate bankruptcy, usually victim claims will come first, right? Which means they were harmed the most. Like, let's not kid ourselves. The United States and state governments were not harmed more than a family member who lost their only kid to an overdose or to somebody who lost a decade of their life in employment and other, you know, housing, et cetera, because of Purdue's products. So those are direct payments, right? The 92.5% that goes to government and corporations, it's going to insurance companies who believe that Purdue, committed fraud against them. It's going to CVS Pharmacy for misrebate payments that Purdue was supposed to make. It's going to the federal government and state governments to reimburse Medicare and Medicaid costs, right? But it sounds like a lot of money because you hear billions of dollars. But what most people don't know, because it's really, you know, in the footnotes of any reporting that you're seeing, is that this is spread out over an extremely long period of time. In Purdue, that settlement will be spread out over 10 or 11 years. In the multi-district litigation, it's going to be spread out over 18 years. So it's pennies in a bucket. And at some point, we have to ask ourselves, you know, when these states say we're doing so much work because look at all this great justice and money we're getting from the opioid settlements, that's total BS. These are services that they say they're going to provide through these dollars that they should already be providing to us as American and state taxpayers. We know that to curb the overdose crisis, we need closer to $20 to $30 billion every single year if we're going to have any shot at combating this, and we're nowhere close to that. So in a sense, the litigation has given politicians a scapegoat to say they're doing something when they're really not doing very much.
So this is a joke. You know, if my math's correct, 7% of 5 billion is 350 million. That's a trickle when you divide it among all the people and all the families that have been devastated by this. It's nothing. And it's very
average of $5,000 a family is what we're looking at. The real number is $750 million in a $10 billion settlement. Guess what? Lawyers are going to collect over $1 billion combined, just 1,000 of them.
Yeah.
They're the ones who are really going to make out in this settlement.
Hey, if you're just joining us now on Clean and Sober Radio, we're talking to Bill Stolfer from the Pennsylvania Recovery Organization Alliance and Ryan Hampton, who is a international, but he's certainly a national person to be reckoned with. And he has sat, as we're speaking now, during the hearings for the bankruptcy of Purdue Pharmaceutical. Bill, what's your take on this? It's so when Ryan gives these numbers out, it's so depressing, and it's, you know, it gives you a hopeless and helpless feeling that you can't fight this.
Well, we can't do that, because the other reality is when people get angry enough people get educated and they get angry enough, things change. But like Ryan said, the only thing that we know for sure is that lawyers are going to make a lot of money. Okay.
Yeah.
And the other part of this is that this trickle of money, like this $5 billion, it's over such a long period of time. They will have more money at the end than they have now.
Oh, the interest on their money.
The interest on their money. Like, of course. They're not losing anything. And that's an outrage
joke
to what has happened to people. We've lost a generation of people. So we cannot lose hope. That's one. And the other thing that we need to do is recognize that this, as Ryan said, we talked about earlier in the program, this is our number one public health problem. Even COVID, right? Like, we know alcohol-related deaths are up 26%. Opioid-related deaths are up 30%. Yeah. We're just actually getting started, unfortunately, with the impact of the epidemic on our population. We better get serious about dealing with addiction. And to get serious about addiction, we have to recognize that recovery is everywhere. And if we want to get more recovery, we have to energize the recovery community. And right now, as Ryan and I recently wrote an op-ed for Stat News, like, most recovery organizations in America are funded by bake sales. As all this money is coming out, the money is going to large universities and big foundations and not the communities. So what happens at the end, we're wallpapering a problem as our ship is sinking. And the reality is, recovery communities deliver in America what we should want more in America. We are civically involved. We work. We take care of our families. We do the things that America needs, and we should energize more of it. And we could do that if we do this set-aside thing, and state governments are held accountable for getting money out to the community, the recovery communities.
And this is not a Republican or Democratic thing.
No.
This is, you know what? Find out who your legislatures are and vote them out if they're not buying into this situation. That's the only way it's going to
change. Educate them.
Because, I mean, the beginning of the show, we read an article about Purdue Pharmaceutical. The way that article was worded was, a mediator will soon outline recommendations for ending Purdue Pharma's bankruptcy, which is expected to provide billions of dollars to address the opioid crisis.
Sounds great, huh?
Yeah.
That's in all the papers.
But, you know, I'm going to tell you something. The media has focused on Purdue, but you got Johnson & Johnson, you got Teva, you got the issues with CVS, Walgreens. There's a lot of people involved with this. It seems like everybody, at least the who are not in the know, just hear about Purdue.
And the other side, just like Ryan was talking about, you got to check his book out, Unsettled. But on the other side is, just like that occurred there, the money that gets all this money is coming into the government. Recovery community organizations are funded by bake sales.
Right.
You know, and think about, like, that's what we need to develop. You guys are in recovery. You know recovery happens in community. The listeners out there, too, like, on this thing, we know you got to support community for people to heal. We're still not doing that.
Yeah, it's a – I'm really depressed now.
You know, Mark,
I am speechless.
You can't be depressed, though, because I've also seen – and by the way, the mediator's report just dropped, so I'm trying to, like, read it in real time while I'm talking to you, because I'm waiting on
multitask, Ryan. Multitask.
I'm multitasking, but I will tell you, it is upsetting. It is outraging. But this is the way that business has been done for so long when we have been shut out. But in this kind of tale of what seems like hopelessness to some, there is a tremendous amount of hope, because we have seen people in recovery and people who are impacted finally stand up to big government, finally stand up to these big corporations, finally making their voices heard. And although we may not be listened to, we may have lost this one, the community is rallying and getting more vocal and not taking this BS on the chin anymore. Like, this is how real social change happens. Like, we're no longer being given just a pat on a head and given, you know, an award during recovery month and standing on a stage with some governor or attorney general. No, I can tell you there are attorney general's offices that do not want to get on the phone with certain people in recovering certain advocates because they know we're educated. They know we're building a constituency of consequence. They know we're getting involved politically. So these are all, there are a ton of positive outcomes coming out of this.
He's
we
right.
may not have yeah. you know, won this specific battle, but over the long term, this has been very healthy for this community. This had to happen at some point.
All right, good. Now, so coming up next on the show, let's talk about positive thoughts. Let's talk about what good things are happening. And stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF now. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
You know, one of our listeners and viewers, Robert Dan, had an interesting correlation to veterans and their families. Unless you're involved directly, people are numb to all of the all of the woes out there. You know, the military also, you know, if you don't have a member, you take that attitude. Unfortunate. That's another place where education is absolutely key. I just want to recognize a couple people here. Ed McCash. Let's see. Janet Ray Pardini. Mimi Dorshu. Let's see. Linda Carroll. Anything else?
My beautiful wife, Andrea Diaz. Hello.
Oh, man.
And Dan Schmalman. Bravo, Ryan and Bill.
Yeah, that's good stuff. John, I think John's off. All right, so guys, let's try to talk now for the next 10 minutes of positive things that are happening. Because, you know, we do focus on overdoses. We do focus on all the bad stuff, but there is a lot of good stuff. There's a lot of people who get into recovery. The three of us sitting here are prime examples, and there's plenty of people, and there's plenty of resources. So go out and get it.
I'll tell you, you know, I have recently been interviewing people who started what is called the New Recovery Advocacy Movement.
Okay.
People like Bill Moyers and Tom Coderre and Donna Dimitrovic and some amazing people. And the reality is that we are here on your show, that you have a show. It comes from these people who said, you know, we got to start talking about recovery instead
right.
of just addiction. So we're standing on the shoulders of people. And if we look at our whole history, everything that we have, a generation ago, we were getting lobotomies and thrown into prison or state hospitals. And that's what we got. You know, so we have come a long way. We have a yeah. long way to go. You know, we yeah. also have some people in government positions who are in recovery and who understand these things need to get done. We have to make them, as that old saying goes, they know what they need to do, but we have to make them do it.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of good stuff going on. These kinds of efforts energize the people. And what we should do, as Ryan has said, is absolutely correct. This is impacting the entire America. And so people have to get energized around it.
And also the justice system is getting better. There are a lot of judges who are now understanding that we can't incarcerate out of this thing. There are programs that are being set up all over the place. So, yes, it is moving. But I want – you know, I'm impatient, okay? I want it to move faster.
I'm curious what Ryan has – what Ryan's perspective on this is.
Well, I mean, I think – you know, we've seen a lot of progress, certainly since I've gotten sober. There are more, we're seeing more and more people getting involved on the ground level in recovery advocacy. We're seeing more and more recovery community organizations sprout up around the country. We're seeing more and more access to training for people who want to become effective advocates for their community. You know, when I first got sober and I talked and I had this, you know, it was in my small community in Southern California where I was living, had this idea of getting politically involved or civically involved around recovery issues, people looked at me like I was speaking another language to them because they said, hey, what does, you know, recovery have to do with politics? Well, you know, recovery as a concept doesn't have anything to do with politics, right? But access to recovery, right? Access to healthcare services, access to housing, access to employment, non-discrimination, non-prejudice against people who are in recovery or suffering with addiction. These are like very highly political ideologies and highly political issues. And I think, you know, the progress is seen as people starting to see that. Every time I travel, and I'm traveling right now, and I go to more and more communities, I'm seeing more and more people who are coming out of the shadows, sharing their stories, and then wanting to take those next steps. You know, Bill does this great blog. I got started blogging as well when I first got sober, and it was an attempt to just get more people to share their stories. Because once we're able to kind of shed that personal shame that existed within ourselves, we see that we're able to use our stories and our experience for good, right? And it's a highly personal decision. And still, even today, people can be, you know, there can be negative impacts to sharing your story. Every situation is unique. But we're seeing more and more people doing this. It's becoming more embedded within society. So there are so many ways people can get involved. And it doesn't have to be political or issue-based advocacy. You know, I mean, folks, there's a menu of options.
You know, I got sober 40 years ago. This show never would have happened 40 years ago. This show never would have happened 20 years ago. So, Ryan, I agree with you wholeheartedly. The change is good. It's just how fast can we really make the change? And, you know, Mark and I are big, you know, the criminal justice system is so – the inequities are so horrible that we're proponents of that kind of correction. You know, this – you know, we mentioned a lot of things, you know, that are affected by the drugs and the alcohol, but the criminal justice system is crippled. You know, the thought of people just staying in prison for years and years and years for this, even though it's changing on the outside, you know, it's not changing on the inside the penitentiaries at all.
Yeah, and to me, it's frustrating because, you know, you see this progress, right, in these areas, but yet overdoses, deaths have doubled in the last 4 years,
And we have a lot of questions to ask then so that we can hold accountability and save our communities.
Well,
I'm really curious. Ryan's reading that report.
Like, yeah, what's going on, Ryan? What's going on with that report, man? What's going on?
Yeah, there was So a supermajority of the states have come to an agreement, but there's not a unanimous consent on a Sackler contribution into the settlement. So there's a possibility that the mediation may go on for another week, or they may need to look at alternative settlement proposals. So basically, we're in the same spot that we were 2 weeks ago.
Limbo.
Yeah,
limbo. That's exactly right. Limbo. I think people just need to understand that, you know, some of the states want to hold out to keep suing the Sacklers, but what people don't recognize is that if that happens, the first one to the courthouse gets to keep all the money. So the state of Washington wants to sue the Sacklers, or the state of Connecticut wants to sue the Sacklers. That's great. Maybe they'll get a little bit more money out of them. But at the end of the day, the state of Connecticut or the state of Washington keeps all that money, so the rest of us that live in other states don't get anything. So there's a lot of political motivation around holding out. And as I said earlier in the program, what we really want are criminal charges against them. And interestingly enough, not one state or the federal government have indicated any intention to do that because, and I will end with this, it was never about justice. It was about money.
Exactly. Hey, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us from Las Vegas. And we're one of the stations in your town. We are on KDWN. So check us out on that station. Ryan, thank you so much. Good luck in all your endeavors. And if anytime you want to come back with Bill or by yourself, feel free. All right, buddy?
Thanks for having me. Appreciate you all.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you, Ryan. Congratulations, Ryan.
Bill, thank you so much again. How much time we have? 2 minutes. Okay. Remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, help is available. 1-800-662-HELP. Seriously, reach out. Make that phone call. But you don't have to live this way. You know? I mean, we wasted a lot of years messing around like this.
You don't. And just to have some hope, you know, to know you can change. That's the most important thing.
Absolutely.
To be able to put that in process.
And that's for real. That's the positive part of an addiction, you know. So for Clean and Sober Radio, I'm Gary Hendler.
I'm Mark Sigmund.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about this broadcast, please join our mission and go to cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com. Have a great weekend. Thanks for all your support, everybody.
Everybody is a star.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
System tries to bring you